Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and my respected friends. Our subject this evening, the Genesis flood, a warning for today, is taken at least in part from the chapter that our chairman read together for us this evening, from Genesis chapter 6. We might just start our considerations tonight by reading together one or two of the verses which he read out of that particular chapter. In Genesis chapter 6, we're obviously given the idea that the state of the world in the days of Noah, at least from a scriptural viewpoint, from a Bible viewpoint, was, well, let's read verse 5. It says in Genesis 6 and verse 5, "And God saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart." You know, one of the interesting things about the Bible is that good Bible reading pays great dividends. You notice how there's a balance there between two hearts in those two verses. You've got the imagination of man's heart, only evil continually, in the fifth verse, and it grieved God at his heart that he had made man in the sixth verse. And so we're told that as a result of the wickedness of man, that verse 12 says, "God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupted, for all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. And God said unto Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth." You know, the Old Testament part of the Bible, the very first part of the Bible document, is actually written in the Hebrew tongue. And in the Hebrew text of the original, which we're reading from an English translation of here, the word destroy in the 13th verse is the same word in the Hebrew as the word corrupt in the 12th verse. There's almost a sense here in which God is going to recompense man according to his own evil. So you see, verse 12 says that man had corrupted God's way upon the earth, and as a result of that, God says, "I will corrupt them with the earth," in the 13th verse. So man was going to be paid back, as it were, in kind, according to how he had treated God's ways. He destroyed God's ways, verse 12, God would destroy him, verse 13. And so we have the story of the flood of Genesis and the story of Noah and the ark. If we come to Genesis chapter 7, to the next chapter, we just read briefly one or two of the verses that the Bible record gives us of the story of this flood in the days of Noah. We're told in Genesis chapter 7 and verse 11, "In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day, were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened, and the rain was upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. Verse 21, "And all flesh died that moved upon the earth, both of fowl and of cattle and of beast and of every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth, and every man, all in whose nostrils was the breath of life, of all that was in the dry land died. And every living substance was destroyed which was upon the face of the ground, both man and cattle and creeping things and the fowl of heaven, and they were destroyed from the earth. And Noah only remained alive, and they that were with him in the ark. And the waters prevailed upon the earth 150 days. So you see, here we have the Bible record of the flood. This was God's judgments upon an ungodly society. A worldwide flood, according to a careful reading of this chapter. You notice what it says there, verse 20, "The mountains were covered." Verse 21, "All flesh died." Verse 22, "All in whose nostrils was the breath of life." Verse 23, "Every living substance was destroyed." This was a worldwide judgment by Almighty God upon the whole of the achievements of mankind to this point of time because of the ungodly society which they had generated upon the earth. The Bible's quite clear and quite specific about this. The Bible says that God brought that judgment upon mankind because of how evil man had become in corrupting God's ways upon the earth. Now, you see, we live in an age of so-called enlightenment, my dear friends, where a lot of people think, oh, well, that's all very well, but that's simply a Bible story. These are Jewish fables. These are Jewish legends. These are set in the Middle East. Maybe there was a flood, perhaps a local one. Perhaps a heavy downpour in the area of the Middle East, but certainly not something of worldwide dimensions. And a lot of people would believe, you see, that the story of the Genesis flood is a little far-fetched. It isn't, you know. There's a tremendous amount of evidence outside of the Bible record that would lead us to the unmistakable conclusion that what God said about this flood is exactly what happened upon the face of the whole earth. This is not just a Bible story. This is the history of the world. This flood really happened. Mankind everywhere really was obliterated by God's hand. Now, I'd like to show you some of the reasons why I believe that to be the case. I think it's important that we establish very clearly tonight that what the Bible says has credibility when we assess it from other aspects. This really did happen. This wasn't just a local phenomenon. We believe that there is substantial evidence in support of the fact that the flood was truly a worldwide judgment upon mankind, just as the Bible said it was. We're going to look at just one or two things by way of illustration. Look, there's many different things that we could look at tonight. We could go on for several hours just looking at evidence concerning the flood. We haven't, of course, got time to do that. One of the things that perhaps is the most striking testimony is the fact that in 72 different languages all around the world, there are records of the flood. There's 80,000 writings all over the world which contain the legend and the story of the flood account. And then we have the testimony of the boulders, what are known as erratic boulders, the fissures in the rocks, the deposits of fossils, the stories of the mountains and the seas of ancient times. We're going to just look at one or two of those briefly tonight to see that what the Bible said really did come to pass, and that therefore we must needs examine the Bible record in some considerable detail. Let's just refer briefly, first of all, to that matter of the literary records. You see, why would there be stories of the flood in different places of the world unless it really did occur? Here's some of them. Just a few. Apart from the Bible account itself, and we've read some of that from Genesis chapter 6 and 7 tonight, there are literary records that abound all over the world. You can see them there. There's accounts in the records of Alaska, Hawaii, Tahiti, North America, Mexico, South America, Iceland, Wales, Lithuania, Finland, Siberia, Greece, Egypt, Sudan, Nigeria, Congo, South Africa here, Persia, India, Burma, China, Japan, Malaya, Sarawak, Indonesia, New Guinea, Australia. Even New Zealand, where I come from, has a legend of the flood amongst the Maoris of New Zealand. Now, why would it be, if the flood wasn't truly a worldwide phenomenon, why would it be that these legends abound from north to south, from east to west, right across the globe, to all four corners of the earth? And the story's the same, about a man called Noah, a man who built a boat, a man who took his family on a boat, a man who put animals on the boat, a boat that floated in a time of a great flood, where everything else died. It's the same story wherever you go. How could that be? Unless the flood really did occur. And the Bible record was right. We put it to you, my dear friends, this evening, that that is exactly the truth of the matter. That what the Bible had to say about this flood is in fact provable from a number of different positions of evidence. What about the story of the erratic boulders? Erratic boulders. Well, erratic boulders are stones that are in places where they ought not to be. So let's have a look at some of these boulders in the wrong places. First of all, we go to the Jura Mountains in Switzerland here in the area of Central Europe. There are rocks that have been taken off the Alpine range of mountains and taken to the Jura Mountains some miles to the west, 2,000 feet above Lake Geneva. So these rocks have been broken off one chain of mountains, transported across a lake and 2,000 feet up another set of mountains onto the top of them. What breaks rocks off one set of mountains and deposits them on the top of another? One of the erratics in that particular range in the Jura Mountains, known as Pierre Amartin, is 10,000 cubic feet in size. These are not pebbles. On the west coast of England, there are enormous quantities of stones which in fact have come not from England at all, but from the mountains of Norway, transported across the North Sea. What power is capable of transporting boulders from Norway and depositing them on the coasts of England? In New Hampshire in America, there is a block near Conway that weighs 10,000 tons that's been transported from somewhere else. The great flat erratic of Warren County, Ohio, weighs 13,500 tons and covers 3/4 of an acre. These are the sort of stones that we're talking about that have been moved. What power is capable of moving stones of this size? On the Carpathian range of mountains, again back in the area of Czechoslovakia in Europe, there lie boulders that have in fact been brought across from Finland. They've been transported across the sea. They've been lifted up right over the top of Poland and brought down onto the Carpathian mountain range in the middle of Czechoslovakia. Any explanation? In the highlands of Brazil, there are great fans of rocks that have been scattered out as if by a giant hand in a large semicircle. But the semicircle runs for miles upon miles upon miles. A giant circle of rocks fanned out, many of them, all across the Brazilian plains. In Sweden, there is a block of chalk that is 3 miles long, 1,000 feet wide, and 200 feet thick. And it's been transported from somewhere and dropped into the middle of Sweden. What force, apart from the rushing waters of a giant, enormous, worldwide flood, is capable of moving rocks of that size and transporting them all across the face of the globe to another part? What about the story of the rock fissures? Cracks in the rock that reveal the story of the flood in another way. In a cave in Kirkdale in Yorkshire in England, there is a cave 80 feet above a valley, and underneath a floor covering of stalagmites, there lie the bones of various animals. There is the bones of elephant, rhinoceros, hippopotami, horse, deer, tiger, bear, wolf, hyena, fox, hare, rabbit, raven, pigeon, lark, snipe, and duck, all in the one cave, all smashed together. Now, you see, elephants and deer, tiger and duck don't normally go together in the same cave. What strange power was it that drove animals from different species in different habitats so that they all ended up in the same place in the one cave? In the isolated hills around Paris and in central France, there lie crevices in the rocks that are packed with animal bones that have been splintered into innumerable sharp fragments. Nobody knows how they've got there. The Rock of Gibraltar, in the region of the Mediterranean, of course, is extensively cracked and fissured in many places. The fissures are crammed with the bones, the smashed bones of animals of all descriptions throughout those cracks. There's a large cave in Palermo in Sicily that's choked with the bones of animals that normally have nothing to do with each other, different natures, different species, different habitats, and all these bones lie together at the foot of one cave. Just to give you an idea of the amount of bones that they've discovered, in one of these caves alone in Sicily, within the first 6 months of discovering the cave, they shipped 20 tons of bones just from one cave. That's a lot of bones. That's a lot of animals. What brought all those animals together to death in that cave? In Chukotian, near Peking in China, in caverns, there lie great masses of animal bones from different species. They've been smashed together. What was it that not only drove those animals into the cave, but then smashed the bones together beyond recognition? In the Cumberland Cavern in Maryland, in America, there lies a strange mass of bones that are all hopelessly intermingled. They're smashed to pieces, but they're not worn by water in any way. It's as if they were just freshly smashed and then immediately covered over. How do we account for the strange story of the bones in the fissures of the rocks all over the world? Unless a worldwide flood drove those animals together in absolute fear and terror and smashed them into their last place of refuge until there was nothing left but just bones upon bones. What about the story of the fossil deposits? The old red sandstone deposit in Scotland, so therefore I should move that a little, shouldn't I? The old red sandstone deposit in Scotland is a very large area. Parts of the area of this particular deposit are made of quartz. This quartz is in fact very, very hard. In fact, it is so hard that it cuts glass and it strikes fire from steel. It's tremendously hard. And yet in that deposit, there is a layer of quartz that's been ground down to pebbles. Now remember, this quartz is exceedingly hard. And some force, some power, has ground that quartz into pebbles. Do you know how high the layer of pebbles is? It's a layer of quartz pebbles 150 feet thick. What power was able to grind that quartz into pebbles of that description? Unless there was some enormous, tremendous power, such as a worldwide flood of water. The La Brea asphalt pit in America, on the western outskirts of Los Angeles, is actually an asphalt pit. It's an enormous pit, about 50 to 100 feet thick. And amongst other bones in the deposit are tiger and wolf skulls at 20 skulls per cubic yard. In the Agate Spring Quarry on the south side of Niobrara River in Sioux County, Nebraska, there is a fossil-bearing deposit with interlocking smashed bones. And one section of 350 square feet yielded 164,000 bones, making up 820 skeletons. And when they look at the whole area, they've worked out that there are literally thousands upon thousands of animals that were carried an unknown distance and smashed together into a common grave. What about the Karoo Formation here in South Africa? covers an area of perhaps some 200,000 square miles. It's been estimated that in that formation there are 800,000 million skeletons. What brought all those animals together to a sudden and violent death? The Cordillera Range in Peru has exactly the same phenomenon. The Harz Mountains in Germany have a strange phenomena inasmuch as there are large deposits in the top of the mountains of fossil fishes. They exhibit all the marks of violent death. Figures contorted, spines curved, fins stuck out, obviously in the throes of convulsions and contortions, showing all the marks of having been removed suddenly from the water and then immediately buried. But these fossil fish are in the top of a mountain range in the middle of Germany. What took them up there? So you see, the story of the fossils is also the story of a worldwide flood where mountains rose and mountains fell, where valleys became new mountains, where the whole land structure changed dramatically, and where the waters of the flood moved violently and powerfully about the earth, producing all of these phenomena that we can witness today now from a geological point of view. What about the story of the mountains and the seas? The Saharan Desert, the desert of the Sahara, is of course the largest desert in the world. It covers about 3.5 million square miles. It's the greatest desert on earth. One of the funny things about the desert of the Sahara is that when one travels around, one finds drawings, cave drawings, and implements from various people that have obviously lived across the desert in the past. And those drawings indicate that the desert of the Sahara was once a vast green area of forest, densely inhabited by man and with lush green pastures. In fact, there was a lake there known as Lake Triton. And at some stage, Lake Triton emptied itself into the waters of the Atlantic. Earthquakes sealed the springs that fed the lake, and what was left was the sand of the lake shore and the lake bed. The Saharan Desert was born. What turns lakes upside down so they empty themselves out? In the Andes Ranges, in the Andes Mountain, there lie the remains of a city. It's built with giant stones on the southern side of Lake Titicaca. And above the city, there's a set of terraces indicating cultivation of vegetables and produce going up the side of the hill beyond the village itself, this particular city that was built. The funny thing about this city is that it's actually 12,500 feet above sea level, and the cultivation terraces actually go up into the present line of snow. Who was growing vegetables up there? Unless perhaps at some stage that particular city was in fact down on a valley, and that valley was in fact uprooted as part of the story of the flood and now becomes a mountain. And the vegetable terraces of this ancient city of yesteryear are now in fact lying in the very region of the snow itself. The Himalayas, of course, are the highest mountains in the world. There's many peaks in the Himalayan range of about 20,000 feet. The highest, of course, is Mount Everest, which is over 29,000 feet. That's over 5 miles high. 5 miles high. And in the top of those mountains, there are rocks filled with the skeletons of fish and sea mollusks, right at the top of the Himalayan mountains. There's obviously something strange that has gone on in the world in the past, hasn't there been? How else do we account for these sorts of phenomena? In the Swiss Alps, there's a cave known as the Drachenloch Cave. It's on a steep snow-covered hill. In fact, it's under eternal snow. And yet the evidences in the cave itself are that man has consistently lived in that cave from the earliest of times. It's perpetually covered under snow at the moment. In the mid-Atlantic Ocean, some oceanographers made a rather interesting discovery. They discovered a beach, a prehistoric beach, sand deposits of a beach. Funny thing about it was, you see, sand is a coastal shelf phenomenon. Sand occurs only on the coastal shelf where the water meets the land. But this was a beach, all right, a definite beach. The only funny thing about it was is that it was 1,200 miles from shore and 3.5 miles down. How do we have a beach in the middle of the Atlantic? Unless the Earth's been violently moved around at some stage in the past. The Arabian Peninsula likewise shows the hallmarks in the past of having been a wonderfully fruitful place until some paroxysm of nature changed it into the present desolate place that it is today. So you see, what we're really suggesting, my dear friends, is this, that the story of the flood of the book of Genesis, the book of the Bible, is perhaps not quite as silly as it sounds. We believe it really happened. And that when God said that it was his judgment upon a world that had become ignorant and willfully ignorant of his ways, and that he intended to judge the earth for the wickedness that had come upon the earth, that the Bible was true. And that is in fact exactly what happened. So you say, well, so what? Well, you see, if God judged the earth because of the conditions of the world in that day, then what would we think if we... Well, let's have a look at Genesis chapter 6 and see what the world was like in the days of Genesis, and maybe we can make the point a little more clearly. So God judged the world in the days of Noah, in the days of the story of Genesis, because of the state that the world had got to. Well, let's have a look at the state of the world in the days of Noah. We're told in Genesis chapter 6 and verse 1, "And it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair." So verse 1 says, it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth. So what Genesis chapter 6 and verse 1 tells us is that the days of Noah were an era of population explosion as far as the world was concerned. Men were beginning to multiply upon the face of the earth. Isn't that what's happening today? In the year 1800, there were 1 billion people on the face of the earth. That number had doubled to 2 billion people by the year 1930. So how long did it take to go from 1 billion to two? In other words, how long did it take to double? Well, from 1800 to 1930, that's 130 years, isn't it, to go from 1 billion to 2. By 1975, it had grown to 4 billion. It had doubled again. How long did it take this time? From 1930 to 1975 is only 45 years this time to double again. By 1989, the population of the world was 5.1 billion, and it's estimated that it will increase to 10 billion in the next 40 years. Wouldn't you say that men are multiplying upon the face of the earth again, as they were in the days of Genesis? In India, there is a baby born every 1.5 seconds. There will be 2,400 babies born in India during the course of this lecture. And associated with that multiplication of men upon the face of the earth is all of the associated social problems and pressures that come upon the earth as a result of that multiplication process. Yes, I think we're living in a similar age to Noah as far as that's concerned. What about verse 2, Genesis 6 and verse 2? that the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. Well, there doesn't seem to be too much wrong with that, but let's read the verse again. The sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all that they chose. Do you know that that verse is taken up in the New Testament, and the world of Noah was condemned for the fact that they were marrying and giving in marriage? When one examines the language in which those phrases are couched, the idea is obviously implicit in the text that it was a time when they were not only marrying once, but they were marrying again and again and again and giving in marriage. It was a time of easy marriage. It was a time of remarriage. It was a time of taking more than one partner. That was the days of Noah. Took them wives of all they chose. Not a problem. If you wanted another wife, you simply went and took another wife. Do you know that in America there are 700,000 divorces a year? That's 75 an hour. In fact, so much so that there's a new business grown up called divorce lawyers. The only thing they do, the only thing they know about is how to organise divorces. In fact, you can go one better than that today. Of course, you can get what's known as a do-it-yourself divorce kit. Save costs. Particularly if you're going to do it more than once. Useful thing to get to know about. Don't we live in a society of easy marriage? In fact, so much so has the standard of world marriage changed, of course, that today we live in an age of what's known as the de facto relationship, don't we? Where people don't bother to get married at all because it's so much easier, perhaps, for later on. In one of the schools in the city that I come from, one of the teachers in a class has a classroom where 93% of his students, of his children, in a primary school, come from solo parents. 93% of the class have only one parent at home, either mum or dad. Because marriage is such an easy thing to either enter into or move out of today. In fact, a few weeks ago, there was an Australian on television who had gained some notoriety, who in fact has 9 wives, 63 children, and receives $225,000 a year in social welfare benefits to keep the whole thing rolling along. State pays for all of that. It's an age of easy marriage. Isn't that the world that you and I live in? What about Genesis chapter 6 and verse 5? And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Look, you don't need me to really discuss whether we're living in an age of moral decline. We know what the world is like today. We know that the standards of our parents and the standards of our grandparents are the things of yesteryear. The days when a man took his hat off to a lady or opened the door for a lady, they're gone. In fact, I remember a few years ago standing up for a lady in a train in New Zealand, and she gave me a withering stare and told me she had absolutely no need of my seat, and I realised that I'd blundered into the middle of a woman's liberation fiend, and I really shouldn't have stood up at all. And so, of course, you know what happens next time. You don't stand up in case you get embarrassed again. And all of the standards of courtesy and gentlemanliness and honesty and integrity, all of the hallmarks of life of a generation ago, they're not there anymore, are they? We know that that's true. You know that that's true. We live in an age of moral decline. You know that 35% of all children born in the world are born illegitimate, born out of wedlock. It's a dreadful age that we live in. Verse 12, and God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. So it was an age of destruction and of pollution. The word corruption here means to decay or to ruin. Mankind had ruined the earth. Isn't that what mankind is doing today? Don't we live in an age when the earth is being carefully, systematically, irretrievably, inexorably ruined by mankind? Since 1950, the world has lost 50% of all its trees. We're cutting down forests at the rate of 50 acres a minute. In fact, the carbon dioxide that comes off the burning of the rainforest of the Amazon accounts for 25% of all the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So vast are those burnings. And an area the size of Belgium disappears in flames out of those forests every year. Pollution? In Hong Kong, little Hong Kong, the little island of Hong Kong, the people on that island dump 1,000 tons of plastic refuse every day. The United States discards enough aluminium to rebuild its entire commercial airline fleet every 3 months. That's a lot of aluminium. In Nizhny Tagil, which is a city in the USSR, it's a factory city, they've had problems for many years there with pollution because they really haven't been environmentally sensitive, and there are pollutants that come out of the factory smokestacks of the industry there. In fact, there's so much smoke that comes out of the smokestacks in that city that in fact it pours out 700,000 tons of pollution just in smoke out of those chimneys every year. In fact, it's so bad in that city that at 12 o'clock noonday you have to drive with your lights on in the city because you wouldn't see otherwise. It's so dark with smoke. Don't we live in an age of pollution? Of man ruining the planet upon which we live? Verse 13 says, at the days of Genesis, the days of Noah, were also the days of crime and violence. God said, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. Actually, I read an interesting paper today, one that I've never read before. It's known as the Sunday Tribune, dated the 20th of December. So I think we're reasonably up to date. So here's the paper from Durban today. US travellers warned of violence in Kenya. The US State Department on Friday advised US citizens travelling to Kenya to exercise caution because of the general election on December the 29th. The probability of violence and other criminal activity will be high during this period. Hindu leader killed in revenge attack. A leader of a Hindu fundamentalist party was shot dead yesterday by suspected Muslims in possible retaliation for the razing of a mosque by Hindus. South African man living in London accused of importing 18 kilograms of dagger worth about Rand 19,000 has been committed for trial in a British court. A pathologically jealous Italian businessman allegedly stalked and hunted down his estranged wife for months before gunning her down outside a luxury holiday apartment earlier this year in Cape Town. Confronted her, she ran away screaming, was felled by a shot in the back, and he then shot her twice in the head at point-blank range. A young policeman watched in horror this week as his police dog, which was grimly hanging onto the arm of a suspected car thief, was deliberately hurled into the path of a speeding car. A Durban gangster known in the underworld as Dirty Dog is believed to have been hired to carry out a hit on a Peter Maritzburg family, papers before the Supreme Court revealed this week. The Durban gangster, known also as Norman, was hired by some neighbours to blow up our houses and kill some of us. Two young women based at a farm in Zambia were abducted and one allegedly raped in a cross-border raid from Zaire this week. The women were abducted at gunpoint and the bandits drove off with them. The Chingola police failed to assist and cooperate in the rescue operation. Six people face murder charges this week in London after the kidnap and torture ordeal of a teenage girl. Susan Kappa, 16, was found on Monday wandering on a golf course, naked and in agony from hideous burns covering her body. She had been tortured with cigarette stubs, injected with drugs, driven to an open plot of land, petrol poured over her, and set alight. She died 2 days later. Sunday's paper. An age of crime and violence. Could we really say that we're living in an age that's greatly different from the age in which Noah lived? You know, one of the most tragic things about the story of crime and violence in the world today is that as an international statistic, I understand that the ratio is as follows. That for every 1,000 crimes that are committed in the earth, only 400 are reported. And for every 400 that are reported, only one conviction is obtained. That's the world that you and I live in. I'd like to take you to one or two New Testament references just to make some observations upon the story of the flood. The first one is in the 1st of Peter chapter 3 and verse 20. Several New Testament passages that have some interesting comments upon the flood of Noah's day and certain lessons that we can observe. We're going to come from the bottom of this particular overhead upwards. The first thing to observe, reading from verse 20, which sometimes were disobedient when once the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was a-preparing, wherein few, that is, eight souls, were saved by water, the like figure whereunto even baptism doth also now save us. So the first point that we want to make from the 1st of Peter chapter 3 is that the flood was survived by a faithful remnant when it came. But as the 1st of Peter 3 says, there was only a few. In fact, only eight. Now, we're not suggesting that there's only going to be eight people left in the world in today's generation. But what we are saying is that one of the warnings of the story of the flood is that there were very few people that were saved in that day. But the judgment still came. In the 2nd of Peter, chapter 3, which is just two or three pages further on, in the 2nd of Peter, chapter 3, and reading perhaps from verse 5, 2nd of Peter, chapter 2, sorry, and verse 5, it says that God spared not the old world, but saved Noah, the eighth person, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood upon the world of the ungodly. So the second point that we note then, in terms of these New Testament comments on the flood, was that the flood was God's judgment upon an ungodly world. And during that time, we notice that it says of Noah in the fifth verse that he was a preacher of righteousness. As a man in his own day, he endeavoured to do what he could, to say what he could, to warn people as well as he could concerning the dangers of the days in which they lived and the imminent bringing of God's destructive power upon the earth in the form of a flood. It was God's judgment upon that age, says the second of Peter. And for most people it came completely unexpectedly, because if you come to the Gospel of Matthew in chapter 24, we're told that for most people it came as an absolute surprise. Quite funny, really. It came quite unexpectedly, according to Matthew chapter 24. And just see how Matthew 24 puts these words. Matthew 24, verse 37. that as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them away, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. They didn't know, says the record, until the flood came. It took them by surprise. Now you think, that's a funny thing, because, you see, didn't it say in this previous chapter that Noah was preaching to them? So how was it that they didn't know? Well, you see, the answer is in another Bible place, in the 2nd of Peter, in chapter 3, it says that they were willingly ignorant. They didn't know. It wasn't that they didn't know because Noah hadn't preached the warning of divine judgment. They didn't know because they didn't want to know. They knew not, says Matthew, until the flood came and took them all away. And we're told that not only did it come unexpectedly, but when it did come, it was not only sudden, but it was all-encompassing in its effects upon mankind. And so in Luke chapter 17 and verse 26 we read, "And as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be also in the days of the Son of Man. They did eat, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage, until the day that Noah came into the ark, entered into the ark, and the flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise, also as it was in the days of Lot, they did eat, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they builded. But the same day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even thus shall it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed." So the flood was an all-encompassing thing that swept mankind away in entirety. As the book of Genesis says, every living thing on the face of the earth died. Now, if the Bible's a new book to you, you may need to take some time to perhaps go away and think about those Bible passages. Make care to take a note of them and take them home and have a good look at them in the leisure of your own home. You need to think about the implication of those passages, because they're very important things. Only a few were saved. It was a divine judgment. It did come to pass. It took most people by surprise, and it was all-encompassing in its effects. Now, my dear friend, if we're living in an age which in every conceivable respect mirrors and echoes the story of Noah's day, why should God not judge the world again? And the answer is, he will. He's promised that he will. He said that he will. In fact, in these very references, "As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be when the Son of Man shall come." You know, there were probably two things, I think, that people said in the days of Noah. I can imagine that people in the main said two things. They either said, "Well, I just don't want to know about it." But the flood came anyway. Or else they said, "I just can't believe it will happen." And I suppose it's easy for us to feel the same, isn't it? That either we want to walk away and just not know about it, to pretend the flood never ever did happen, that the story of Noah never really did exist, or that we just can't believe that God would do such a thing. He has, my dear friends, and he will do it again. The Genesis flood is a warning for today. It's a warning that God intends to judge the earth again for its wickedness. It won't be a flood. God's promised that it won't be a flood. He's given his assurance that it won't be. But it will be his judgment. And he will overturn the earth again just as completely as the flood overturned it in the days of Noah. and there will only be, relatively speaking, a few that will be saved. Now that's what you need to know more about. That's what we all need to know more about. How do we know, how do we find out about the few that were saved? Well, of course, I suppose the man of the moment, the man of the day, the hero of the hour was Noah himself. What did Noah do? Well, the Bible says, Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with faith, built an ark to the saving of his house. So we need to know a bit about faith. We need to find out what sort of ark it is that God would like us to build, because his judgments are coming again. Unless you think that that represents a slightly morbid conclusion to our address, we should point out that the judgments that God intends to bring upon the earth are in the nature of cleansing the earth again, in a sense, just as the flood did. God's going to start again. There's going to be a new world, a new age. And there isn't going to be crime and violence. There isn't going to be pollution. There isn't going to be easy marriage. There isn't going to be endless population explosion. There isn't going to be moral decline. There's going to be a reinstatement of all principles that are good and holy and just and true. There's going to be a new world order. But God has to cleanse the earth first before that order can be established. And our interest is in how we get ourselves, how we make the transition from this present age through the judgments of God cleansing the earth into the new world and better order of things that God intends to introduce. Now, if what we've said tonight has interested you from the Bible, we do urge you to take these things firm. Because our address tonight is on the subject of the Genesis flood and how it constitutes a warning, we haven't got time tonight to talk about what God does intend to do in the new world order. But suffice to say this, that the Bible says that the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. How far do the waters cover the sea? The waters are the sea. In fact, what the Bible says is that the earth is going to be flooded with God's glory. But that's not our subject tonight. But it is, God willing, the subject next Sunday night, as our chairman will announce to you. And if you'd like to know about the world order that will supersede God's judgments that we believe are shortly coming, then we urge you to give attention to these things further and perhaps to take the opportunity to join us, God willing, next Sunday at the same time. We live in an age, my dear friends, that badly needs the hand of God and the hand of his Son in restoring the earth to a better system of things. And we believe that that day is soon coming. Observe the lessons from the day of the flood in Noah's time. And remember that there were people in his day that also believed it would never come to pass. But the stones and the bones and the mountains and the seas all tell us that it did. Don't be deceived. God's judgments are just and he does carry them through. We urge you to look further into these things and to be prepared for the coming of the Son of Man from heaven, who will come because we are living in the days of Noah again, who will bring God's judgments upon the earth, but who will also introduce a new and better order of things that we can all look forward to and rejoice in.